I'm going to use that.
All right, everyone, we're going to call this Commerce Committee meeting to order. We do have a quorum. Is there a member that has reviewed the minutes from our February 15th meeting? Representative Stensrud, would you mind approving the minutes, please?
I approve these minutes. I move.
Representative Stensrud moves the meeting, the minutes from the meeting on February 15th. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are adopted. Welcome to Telecom Day, everyone. With that, Representative Hoppe is up at the table to discuss House File 1692 as well. We're going to have a couple presentations as well, the first being from Mr. Campbell of CenturyLink, so he can make his way up to the front testifier table. And with that, we will turn things over to Chair Hoppe.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And you could feel the excitement in the day.
Yeah.
Telecom deregulation
day.
I've heard rumors people are even printing out new telecom maps today. Very exciting stuff. Thank you, Representative Davids. We have been talking about doing this on a bipartisan basis with Representative Johnson and Atkins and Thiessen and Beard and a number of us for a number of years. The plan is to look at the parts of last year's House File 1692 that the FCC didn't make irrelevant. Talk about it today. Have everybody come down to that wants to, for good or for ill, talk about it. Good ideas, bad ideas, things we should take a look at, things we shouldn't, and then spend a week or two or 10 days or 2 weeks, whatever it works out to be, and we'll let everybody know the next date. But the idea is to get together two or three weeks from now and have a date when we can take a look at the changes, and hopefully, while we might not have something that everybody loves, maybe we can come up with something that everybody only hates a little bit, and we can try to reform the telecom statutes with an eye towards just updating statutes that in some cases haven't really ever been looked at, and try to make a more fair, more even regulatory playing field for all concerned. And with that, maybe we'll start with the presentation on what the FCC did for us or to us last year, and after that then we can talk about what we might want to do.
Sounds good, Mr. Chair. Welcome to the committee, sir. If you would, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed
Thanks,
with your
Mr.
presentation.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jim Campbell. I'm the Regional Vice President for CenturyLink for Regulatory and Legislative Affairs for the Midwest region. And for the record, the FCC never does anything for anybody. They always do it to somebody. So I'm here to try and give people an idea what happened in this FCC order that you've all heard about that was adopted at the late last year. The chairman said, it was really kind of the culmination of about 2 years' worth of work by industry as they took a look at the telecom landscape and what it was like going forward and decided that, you know, the stars kind of aligned with Jupiter, and now's the time to do something to bring about some regulatory reform and trying to bring the regime into the modern era. It is, it's being driven largely by competition. It's also being driven a great deal by advancements in technology as we move towards a broadband network. And the federal regime and to the chairman's point, a lot of the state regulatory regimes are just a little bit antiquated. So this FCC order is probably the most comprehensive piece of legislation since the 1996 Telecom Act. And essentially, the FCC had four stated goals. One thing they wanted to do was try and reform what's called intercarrier compensation. And that's the amount that companies pay each other to use their network. And I'll go into that a little bit more in detail. The second aspect of it was, and this was probably the most contentious as the industry got together, and when I say industry, I mean the larger price cap carriers such as AT&T, Verizon, and CenturyLink, some of the rural telephone companies, the CLECs or competitive local exchange companies, the wireless companies. We were all at the table discussing how this was going to take place. And as a result of changing the compensation regime by which carriers pay each other amounts to use the network, that resulted in a substantial revenue loss to most everyone involved. And so the second part that the FCC was trying to accomplish was to figure out how companies like CenturyLink and rural companies could recover, find a mechanism where they could recover maybe not all, but a substantial portion of the revenue that's going to be lost as a result of these prices going down. And I'll discuss that in more detail too. The third thing they wanted to accomplish, and this is probably the most important aspect of it, was the federal subsidy program. When the telecom, in 1934, when telecommunications exploded across the country, the federal government set up a mechanism by which carriers could get federal funding to make sure that we could get affordable telephone service to rural, high-cost areas. Currently, there's $4.5 billion set aside every year that goes out to telecommunications companies across the country to try and get phone voice service to areas that don't have it. I think the FCC sort of realized, okay, we can check that box off. We're in a modern age here. Let's kind of blow up the old regime, which admittedly needed help, take that $4.5 billion, convert it to broadband, where we try and switch it and transfer it so that money goes out to carriers to now get broadband to rural, unserved, and underserved areas. And that's probably the most far-reaching accomplishment of this order. And as the chairman said, like most pieces of legislation, we're all pretty happy with the way it went. Not everybody's completely happy. But where this was going without getting anything done is a lot worse than where we are with this order in place. So I think the FCC got it right. They at least got us going in the right direction. And then the final and probably most important goal, of course, was to condense this all into a scant 784 pages with a new set of confusing acronyms that's more than any other piece of federal legislation to date. So I'm going to try and keep this in plain English. A lot of the slides you're going to see contain what I'll call bellhead speak. I'm not going to talk to that. I'm going to try and keep this at a high level so you can kind of understand how this went.
So we appreciate that, Mr. King.
No problem. So the first acronym, ICC, which is Inter-Carrier Compensation. This was the first. What the deal is right now? We have a local company. Long distance companies pay access charges to local companies to ride the network to complete and originate a call. So, as an example, if you're making a call from the Twin Cities to Denver, and you're using, let's say, Sprint as your long distance provider, Sprint would pay CenturyLink a charge to originate the call in the Twin Cities, and then would pay a charge to terminate the call. Probably to CenturyLink in Denver, or it might be AT&T if it's going to some places in California. And those charges have been in place for a long time. And there's been bone of contention at the state commissions over the last 20 years as to what the proper rate should be. Obviously, the long-distance companies want the rates to go down. The local companies, it is revenue. They wanted the rates to remain where they are. And so there have been fights, and we've been trying to resolve this at the state commission level for a long time with, admittedly, very little success. And so the FCC said, look, we're going to take at least the terminating portion of this, and we're going to take it away from the states, and we'll deal with it at the federal level. But to give you an idea why these originating and terminating charges were set up, the best example on the terminating side, it's kind of an artificial subsidy. To use FedEx, if you go send a FedEx package, you pay the FedEx office when you send the package. You pay for the use of the truck, the use of the gas. You don't charge the person at the end who receives the FedEx package a charge. That's kind of what the terminating charges were originally designed for, and they were designed when, frankly, CenturyLinks of the world were regulated monopolies with a guaranteed rate of return. So the FCC said, look, we're going to step in on the terminating side. That's the charge you pay to end the call. And over a period of time, we're going to reduce that charge to essentially zero. So CenturyLink, whatever you charge, that rate is going to be zero within 6 years. Or it's called bill and keep, but it's essentially zero. Now, with each of these charges, there's two different levels. There's interstate, which is a call that crosses state lines, and then intrastate, which would be a long-distance call that's made within the state of Minnesota. The intrastate charges are higher than interstate charges, again, designed kind of as an artificial subsidy that helped the local phone companies get revenue to bring affordable phone service to high-cost areas. So the way this is going to ratchet down on the terminating side is the FCC said within 2 years you've got to take interstate to intrastate levels, intrastate to interstate levels, and then over a period of 4 years after that, you're going to ratchet it down to zero. And so within 6 years, it will be zero. And it's a substantial revenue loss to local phone companies. Now, these charges were going down by the very nature of our industry. As you know, people cut the cord. It's an incredibly competitive business. I mean, I think the statistics now show that 25 to 30% of subscribers in America have cut the cord and no longer have a landline. So these minutes and what we call them access charges, they were gradually going down anyway. But nonetheless, it is still a substantial revenue hit to companies like CenturyLink. So the FCC got us at a table and they said, okay, we understand you're taking the revenue hit and we don't want you to fall off the cliff and take it. In the case of our company, it's company-wide and we operate in 37 states now. It's about over $300 million. They said, we're going to allow you to recover some of that money by adding charges onto the bill if you can absorb the charges. So let's deal with CenturyLink as a price cap carrier. They said, okay, CenturyLink, you can charge no more than 50% a year, per month, per year, up to $2.50, okay? And because you're taking a hit and the access minutes were going down in any event, we're going to make you can only recover 90% of the revenue you lost. So we're going to make you take a 10% hit right off the bat. And in addition, we're going to cap the rates at 30. Now, not many markets we have rates that if you take the basic local rate plus all the add-ons and charges that get near 30. But as an example, if you add all the charges that are on there, USF charges, state charges, the basic local charge, if you had a rate of $29.75, then you could only take a 25-cent charge on this. This, you know, again, this was part of the order that we were moderately happy with. Obviously, we're not going to recoup all the revenue we lost, but we understand that without doing this, if you fast-forwarded to 2016 financially, it looks a lot worse for these companies than it would with this order in place. So again, this is kind of the spirit of compromise of all parties involved, and you're going to hear from different groups as to what the revenue impact is. I mean, some I know have advocated that it's larger than it is, and the sky is falling. I don't think the sky is falling. Again, there is a revenue impact, but we do have a recovery mechanism. And the biggest thing the FCC did, and the thing I want to spend the most time on, is the Universal Service Fund. As I stated, and you know, in all the local phone bills, you have a charge that goes, that is collected by CenturyLink and other phone companies, that goes to fund the state Universal Service Fund. It is old. To be perfectly honest with you, the way the money gets doled out today is very political. You have states that probably don't have as much high cost need getting more money, and other states, you know, larger rural, more vast states in the West that don't get as much money as some of the East Coast states did. And so it really is kind of a broken system now. And so what the FCC did is essentially blew it up. And they said, we're going to redirect this $4.5 billion to broadband. We think broadband is the technology of the future regarding economic development, telemedicine, education, and the like. And we want to make sure that broadband gets deployed as far out into this. Is that me?
You're good.
Sounds like a Who concert. All right. We want to make sure that this gets deployed as far out into the network and into the population as possible. So the other thing that the FCC tried to do with this, and again, this is still a work in progress, they tried to create some financial and fiscal discipline around this. It used to be that companies would go in, they'd get their what's called an ETC certification, an eligible telecommunications certificate, where they would get the federal funds. The FCC said, now we want you to have a business case. We want this money to go to places that truly need it. And so they tried to put some financial and fiscal discipline around the way that carriers can go and ask for the money to deploy. And so this created a new acronym, CAF. That's the Connect America Fund. And essentially, here's what it does. I'll start at a high level and then kind of work my way down. The $4.5 billion that's currently dedicated for subsidy for voice service over the course of 5 years, 20% per year, is going to be transferred and converted over to pure broadband. So at the end of 5 years, essentially there will be no further federal subsidy for voice, and it will all be going to deploy broadband networks. Now, that being said, obviously a broadband network, for the most part, can support a voice product. So if you deploy a broadband capable network, voice will be a logical tag along. So it's not like, you know, the voice investment is going away. It will be there. But over the next 5 years, that's a substantial amount of money that will be distributed to the states in order to deploy broadband. In addition, $300 million of it is going to be used to deploy what's called fixed wireless internet. Most higher broadband speeds today are brought to customers through a wireline or fiber-based network, but obviously wireless technology is advancing as fast as the wireline technology, and the wireless companies continue to invest in scientists and labs to try and figure out how to get those speeds over a wireless network greater than they are today. So $300 million of it will be used towards fixed wireless. So of course we couldn't do this all at once. There has to be a CAF one and a CAF two. So we wouldn't, God forbid, we'd want to make this easy. Let me talk about CAF one first. Essentially, here's what the FCC did here. They said, okay, we don't have a model right now by which large companies can go and ask for this money. So we need to take 12 to 15 months to come up with the proper model to make sure we don't screw it up, to make sure that the money, the ideal goal is to make sure the money gets deployed where it needs to get deployed. In the meantime, we don't want to create a gap where there's no investment being made. So we're going to freeze the high cost fund where it sits today as of the 2011 figures, and we're going to give some money out in 2012 while we work with the FCC, at the FCC with industry and state commissions and all the stakeholders to come up with the proper cost model. So CAF 1, which is the money that's available now, is really kind of a stopgap until we come up with the more permanent model. Under the CAF 1, this would only go to deploy to unserved areas, and unserved is defined as anybody that doesn't get internet speeds of 768 megabits per higher, and that's pretty slow. I mean, that's not much better than dial-up. So the money this year, they're going to designate a little bit of money, 20% of that. They're going to give that out to eligible providers, and you can go deploy your networks. They put some conditions on CAF 1 that a lot of the carriers don't like as much, and this is currently being negotiated. Example, under the CAF 1, if you take money, if you elect to take money under this, then you have to spend at least $775 for every unit you pass. So in the case of CenturyLink, our frozen mechanism over the 37 states that we serve would be about 90 million units. $90 million, which means using the $775 threshold, we would have to hit 115,000 homes that have no internet service. That's going to be that threshold, and I think a lot of the carriers are in there talking to the FCC, is a little bit low. We think with 90 million, we might be able to hit 75,000. So we're currently working with the FCC and other carriers, many of whom are represented in this room, to try and get that threshold changed. Another condition they placed on it is they said that you can't, if you take this money, you can't invest it where there is a fixed wireless service provider offering internet service in that area. Well, back east, I don't know if it's as much of an issue for Verizon and AT&T, who serve more of the dense areas, but out west where CenturyLink serves, we have more fixed wireless providers than any other telecommunications company. So that cuts out a lot of the population that would be eligible to get this money. So we're working with the FCC right now to try and get some of the conditions on this money kind of watered down a bit. Now, the good news about this is, God forbid, if you go take a $90 million or $100 million, you actually have to develop a business case around it, which I think is good. I mean, I don't think that's been the case in the past. So the FCC has said, if you're going to take the money, you've got to put your money where your mouth is. You got to get two-thirds of that built within 2 years and complete it within three. So you have to come up with a business case that says we're going to be able to take the money, and if we agree to whatever threshold it is, 75,000, 80,000, we have to have that hit within 3 years. So what does this mean for the states? The states are going to be the ones that are going to have to administer this. So the state PUCs, their roles, even though this is designed to kind of move toward a path of deregulation, they're going to have a tremendous role in this process as we try and implement this order. And that they're going to be the ones monitoring this, making sure it gets spent where it should get spent. And so we're going to continue to work with the state or state commissions as we deploy this. Moving on to CAF 2. Now, this is really going to be where the rubber meets the road. There were a lot of concessions in this cost model, or in CAF 2 as we try and develop this cost model. The FCC wants to get it done by the end of this year. And here's the way, CAF 2 is a little complex, but in essence, here's the way it's going to work. If you have the obligation to serve, the carrier of last resort obligations, which the large price cap carriers have, we're going to set up a model where for a period of 5 years, we're going to allow you on a state level basis to be the exclusive provider in your area and take what's called a first right of refusal to get CAF money. So let's just use this as an example. Say when all this at the end of the day comes, the cost model's done and the FCC decides after it goes through the washing machine and gets spit out on the other end that $70 million is available to Minnesota per year to deploy underserved and unserved broadband areas. And of that $70 million, I'm speaking for CenturyLink, say we serve probably one of the, if not the largest, rural provider in the state. So say 50 of that would be available to us. We would have to elect on a statewide, we would have to look at this, we'd have to cover that area over a period of 3 years, and if the 50 million, if it looks like we can make a business case out of it and cover those areas or a percentage of those areas, whatever the FCC decides at the end of this year, then we'll take the money. But a lot of this is going to be decided this year, and if the FCC does not get the model right, then companies like CenturyLink would choose not to take the right of first refusal, and we wouldn't take the money. Let me give you an example. Let's say that of that $50 million, the FCC says you have to take that $50 million and you have to get 4 megabit speeds to 90% of the subscribers in your areas, CenturyLink, within 3 years. And if we run the numbers and we say, you know what, it's going to cost us $500 million to get 4 megabit speeds to all of our underserved, 90% of our underserved and unserved areas, we might not take the money. We have to, if it's going to cost us $100 million, we might take the $50 million and spend $100 million of our own capital. All this is going to happen over the next 12 months. So as we meet with state commissions and we talk with state legislators, we urge you to help us and advocate at the FCC to make sure they don't get this right. Because if they don't get it right and companies like CenturyLink and Frontier elect not to take the money, then it goes to a competitive bidding process. And that sounds good, and I think it will go to a competitive bidding process after 5 years. We get the money for 5 years if we take it, and then it converts over to the competitive, the bidding process. The problem is there's no process in place right now. So they have no way to open this up for bidding. They have no rules. They're going to have to develop those. They're going to have to develop, you know, pre-qualification certifications, and they're going to have to develop systems and a way to make sure that they're getting, you know, notice out to all the bidders. There's going to be a time gap and a coverage gap if we elect to not take the money. And the problem there would be is in Minnesota, if we don't take, and we in Frontier and others elect not to take the right of first refusal, you're going to see a 2 to 3 year gap where no investment is being made and there's no federal subsidy coming into Minnesota. So it is imperative that they get the model right. And they desperately want the price cap carriers to take that right of first refusal to get started on the broadband deployment before they open it up to the competitive bidding process. Now, the bidding process, that will happen. After the 5 years, all of this money is going to be opened up to competitive bidding, and that's not going to be on a state-level basis. It's actually going to be on a much smaller basis, which I think is probably good. We tried to get the FCC to do the right of first refusal on a census block by census block basis. And the reason you want a smaller target is because then you can really identify those areas that truly are unserved and underserved. If you have to do it on a statewide basis, it's going to be harder to really target and get the monies invested in the areas that need it. But once the competitive bidding process opens in 5 years, then this all switches over to a very targeted census block by census block arrangement. So taking an area in rural Minnesota we might bid on a census block. You might get the cable company to bid on a census block. You might get an independent, rural telephone companies. We'll all be able to go in and competitively bid for this. So once they get the rules right, I think it will be good for competition. It will be good for investment. It will be good for economic development. But in the meantime, you could have a bit of a gap where no investment is being made if they don't get the model right. So that's sort of it. I guess I would leave you with the following. One, it's a large and complex order. It did preempt certain state initiatives, i.e. terminating access charges. Originating access charges, the FCC did not deal with. They did not preempt that. That is still a state issue. However, I think you'll find that they're probably going to act on that within the next 12 months, so originating access will probably be a moot point. Although, even though this was preempted, the one thing it did not preempt was states regulating carrier of last resort obligations. Those states that have a state high cost fund, Minnesota does not have one right now, but it did not touch state high cost funds. There will still be in those areas the need for voice subsidy in the more rural areas. And the other thing, it's going to create a whole heck of a lot of work for us. I call it a regulatory lawyer's annuity, because this is going to be a 5 to 7 year process as we try and get this implemented. And the states are going to play a tremendous role in that as we move this forward. So, you know, all in all, it's a good order. It gets us going in the right direction. There are things we don't like about it as a price cap carrier. There are things that the rural companies don't like about it as rate of return carriers. I'm sure the cable companies probably had some heartburn with it, along with the wireless companies. But we truly got here because we had a spirit of collaboration, and everyone gave a little bit at the office. So even though there are things that that are not perfect about it, there are petitions and litigation being filed in motions for reconsideration to change certain aspects, I really think this order gets us going in the right direction. It's smart to convert these federal subsidies to broadband. It's smart to put some fiscal discipline around it, and hopefully it kind of gets the regulatory regime into the modern era and past sort of that old monopoly rate of return era that is certainly gone as we face competition at all levels. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to any questions you might have. If I thoroughly confused you, I tried not to use too many acronyms. I didn't talk too much to the PowerPoint, and hopefully it wasn't plain English. When we tell telecom jokes, we actually laugh at them. It's pretty pathetic. But if there's any questions, please, I'd be happy to answer them.
Well, thank you, Mr. Campbell. Greatly appreciate it. Very informative. First question is Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Campbell, I might have missed this, or I had to step out for a minute. When you're talking about the companies that are going to, if they assume people take that the right of first refusal and start acting in that way, and there's money that comes back to the state, does that ever come back to the state? Does it go to the PUC, the Department of Commerce, or do the companies just have to spend that? And if they do, if they're spending that on infrastructure or whatever it would be, who is the FCC monitor that, or do we have to do that on a state basis?
Mr. Chairman, I think that, first of all, the answer is probably going to be part of this cost modeling process. I see the state commissions playing a role as we develop business cases. If we take these funds, and we're going to have a deployment plan, I see the state commissions playing a role in monitoring to make sure that we are meeting the whatever deployment plan we come up with. And regard to your first question, the money, it's going to be the same certification process that exists today. So if we qualify and take the money would come to the carrier, and then we would have reporting obligations as we deploy it.
Did that Representative Hoppe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, that's what I thought you said. I didn't know if it was going to come to the state as a direct, you know, part of what used to be the USF money, and then we would have to figure out how to. I just didn't want another pot of money coming in that we would have to keep an eye on. So,
yeah, Mr. Campbell. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Campbell, did I hear you say in your talk then essentially that CenturyLink might be hesitant to accept that Connect America fund money at this time because of the broadband requirements are so rigorous it might not make economic sense of a business plan to do so, and that's one of the things you're kind of trying to figure out.
Mr. Campbell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Sheldon. I think I was sort of using a hypothetical. We're not sure yet if we're going to take it. The model has not been created. That's something that's going to happen over the next 12 months. So as we meet with the state commissions and state regulators, again, we're urging them to advocate at the FCC to make sure they get the model right. If they get the model right, we would absolutely elect to take the funds. So I think, Representative, I was trying to use an example. We don't have a position yet because we don't know what the final terms look like.
Representative Johnson.
And when, Mr. Campbell, do you think we would see the model that you're discussing so that you'd know whether it made sense or not? Are we talking next couple of months or next 6 months?
Mr. Campbell.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sheldon, there's really two models we're looking at. Remember, CAF 1, which is the frozen support, would be, I think, the end of March. The FCC is going to come up with those numbers. And I think we're making headway on getting some of those conditions lightened a bit. I think there's a high probability that we would take the CAF 1 money, and that would be in the next 90 days. The CAF 2 model, the FCC has targeted December of 2012 to try and get that completed. I may miss this because I'm not at the FCC. We have to file a proposed model, I believe, in April, but I may have those dates wrong. And then they will start the process at the Wireline Bureau of hashing it, putting it through the washing machine, as I said. So then in December, once that model comes out, then CAF 2 would go into effect, and that would start the first right of refusal that we talked about.
Representative Johnson.
Is it fair to say that the telecommunication world is a little bit in a time of unsettled, not chaos isn't the right word, but...
No, I think chaos is a great word.
Okay. And the reason I ask is I get a little worried about moving any major telecom legislation statewide at this time until we really know what's going on at the FCC level and how it permeates, you know, the ILECs and the CLECs and you know, the different telecom players throughout the state. Do you have any sense of that?
Mr. Campbell.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, you know, it depends on what's in the state legislation. Obviously, you wouldn't want to do any legislation that would jeopardize any CAF funding coming into the state. The way that would likely happen would be if you had a state high cost fund and tried to do something with the state high cost fund. That could actually have an effect on CAF funding. There is no state high cost fund in Minnesota. It really depends on what the legislation was in the state, because the state still plays a role regulating telecom from a service quality perspective. They play a role in regulating the carrier of last resort obligations, and if you touch those at all in a piece of state legislation, I don't think it would have any effect on the funding. Hope that answered your question.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Campbell, you know, Bill and Keep's a big part of the order. Did you go into that much in your presentation here? I was actually talking to someone about his map and so forth, your redistricting. But I don't recall you directly speaking to the issue of Bill and Keep.
Mr. Chairman, Keep. Representative, yes, I touched on that when I talked about the FCC preempting the terminating access portion of it. And over a six-year period, at least for price cap carriers, that would go to Bill and Keep, which is essentially zero. And then we talked about the recovery mechanisms in the form of what's called SLIC, which is another acronym, subscriber line charges, that we would be eligible to pass on to recover a portion of the revenue we lose by those access charges going down.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Will there be other testifiers to this, too?
We do have some for the bill that are scheduled.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thad, I think you can hang tight there just for a moment. We're going to bring Representative Hoppe back up to the front. Chair Hoppe.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if we doesn't look like anybody has any more questions for Mr. Campbell or about the FCC. Maybe we want to see if there's anybody in the audience that wants to come down and talk briefly about this, and then we can move into the bill and put the amendment on, taking all the things out that the FCC changed, and then we can have everybody that wants to come down and talk about what we're going to do in terms of deregulation.
Absolutely. We will, at this time, open it up to anyone in the audience that does wish to testify. I do have on my list Mr. Scott Bowler, if he's in the room at this time. Since he's on the list, we'll let you come on up. And welcome to the committee, and please just introduce yourself for the record and then proceed right into your testimony.
Mr. Chair, actually, I'm Jack Phillips with Frontier Communications. Scott's in another meeting. We weren't sure which one of us would be here.
Well, we're glad you're here. Welcome.
Thank you. Committee members, Mr. Chair, my name is Jack Phillips. I'm Director of Government Affairs for Frontier Communications. I'm based in our regional headquarters in Burnsville. Cover 8 states, and I want to just basically kind of give some background on Frontier Communications and the evolution we're going through in terms of transitioning from a voice to a broadband provider, and touch on the impact that the FCC order is going to have on us, and then transition into the need for some regulatory reform. As many of you know, Frontier is an incumbent local exchange carrier. We're in a transition from being a voice communications provider to one, a broadband provider. And in addition to the broadband services, we offer computer backup, data backup, computer support, home networking support. We also have a partnership arrangement with DISH, in which we provide video services, direct broadcast video services. We provide service in 167 communities across the state. We provide from one corner to the other, from the Canadian border and International Falls down to the Iowa border with Blooming Prairie. From the South Dakota border, we our Madison Exchange over to Taylor's Falls. We provide service, as I said, to 167 communities. And unlike some of our competitors, we provide service throughout the entire service area, not just the municipal area. We provide service to the rural areas of the community. In northern Minnesota, we provide service to Isabel, an unincorporated community that only has 98 customers. We also serve some of the larger communities in the South Metro area, the Burnsville, Apple Valley area. So we really serve a large mix from one corner of the state to the other. We are in a transition, as I said, to providing broadband service. We have 528 employees across the state. A lot of those are in our Burnsville office, where we have a regional headquarters. We have 190,000 voice access lines in the state. That's down from a little over 250,000. We've lost a little over 60,000 access lines as a result of competition, some pretty intensive competition within our market. We are the second largest retail rate regulated company in the state, but by my best estimate, we're about the sixth largest voice communication carrier in the state. There are two carriers in the state, CenturyLink and Frontier, that are regulated as large local exchange carriers, but we compete against other providers, including Comcast, Verizon, AT&T, Sprint, in our markets, as well as Charter. Our broadband service has become our flagship product. We have extended our footprint within the availability of broadband within our footprint to 93.6%, and I got as precise as the 0.6% because the first 70 or 80% were not that difficult, but it's becoming increasingly difficult to reach that last 10% of customers. And we are continuing to invest not only in the expansion of our network, the availability of our services, our broadband service, but also the speeds at which we offer those services. And we've reached a point where, as Mr. Campbell touched on, we really do need some support. We're now reaching into areas that are not economical to provide service to in terms of offering broadband service, but the CAF program through the FCC will enable us to expand our reach. Like CenturyLink, we are a price cap company at the FCC, and I think Mr. Campbell, I won't go through that, did a good job of explaining the impact, and the impact that he described is very similar to the impact that would have on Frontier as a price cap carrier serving a rural market. There is some, as he mentioned, there's some good and there's some bad to the FCC order. It's not ideal, it's not perfect, but it's clearly a step in the right direction. It really refocuses from providing voice services to providing broadband services. And, you know, whether we like it or not, that's the direction we need to head. And I think from a larger public policy perspective, it is clearly headed in the right direction. It recognizes that we're now in a broadband world, that voice service in many cases is a feature or an application on a broadband broadband pipe, whereas a few years ago, voice was the primary service, with internet service being kind of an add-on to those services. Minnesota's regulatory framework was established back in 1995. The primary framework under which we're regulated today was established back in 1995. That was 17 years ago. As old as I'm getting, 17 years ago doesn't seem that long, but when you go back and look at what the market, the telecommunications market, looked like at that point, there's been a true transformation since that time. There were no cable providers providing voice service. DSL and high-speed internet were largely unheard of except for very large commercial customers. So we think the time is right. I handle government affairs in the central region for 8 states, including Minnesota, Iowa, Nebraska, Wisconsin, Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, and Ohio. There's one state out of those 8 that has not gone through major telecom regulation reform recently, and that's Minnesota. We're still operating under a regime that was in place 17 years ago. Until a reorganization, I also had the West region for Frontier Communications, which included the notoriously regulated state of California. And back in 2007, retail prices were de-tariffed there. The commission had the authority to deregulate and actually permit companies to de-tariff their regulated services. I guess I want to make a point that what we're asking for is not wholesale deregulation, but that we be permitted greater pricing flexibility to compete at a retail level. I think that this committee is really in a unique position right now. The time is right to align the FCC's order that they just came out with state law, and really sort of realign the direction of the state so that we're focusing less on voice service and creating an environment where broadband services can prosper. That's all I have in terms of presentation. If there are any questions, I'll try to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Phillips. Representative Johnson has a question for you.
When you refer to price cap carrier, you're talking about an ILEC, is that correct?
Yeah.
Is that the same thing?
They're actually two different kinds of carriers of the from an access perspective at the FCC. There are price cap carriers, which generally are the larger carriers. There are also rate of return carriers, and some, there's sort of a couple of subcategories under that, including average schedule companies, and there are some smaller average schedule companies in the state. But we are as part of the larger category.
Thank you, Mr. Phillips. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Phillips. We appreciate your time with us. Representative Hoppe, back to you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe now would be a good time to move House File 1692, and I think the plan for today is to not pass this or do anything with it other than lay it over, but I do think that we should put the amendment on that strips out all the parts that aren't necessary, thanks to our friends at the FCC. So, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 1692, and unless there are any specific early questions on it, I'd also move the A2 amendment to get it down to more of what I think we should be looking at.
Representative Hoppe moves House File 1692. is before us, and Representative Hoppe moves the A2 amendment.
And Mr. Chair, maybe we'll want to have Mr. Eliff, who drafted the amendment, just kind of run through it carefully just to let everybody, or not carefully, but just kind of let everybody know essentially what we're doing is, and he can put it in legal terms, but get rid of the anything having to do with the things that the FCC already did, so that we don't have to do, and the parts of the bill that were a little bit controversial last year.
Yeah, Mr. Eliff, could you shed some light, please?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. It's pretty simple, really. Line 1.2 just updates the bill. It's now a bill in 2012, so we had some dates to update. Line 1.3 and 1.4 refer to some of the language regarding interstate access charges that the FCC has taken over, as Mr. Campbell told us. Line 1.5, again, is updating some dates. 1.6 through 1.12 is also additional language regarding interstate access charges. And the last line, 1.13, is simply a wrong reference that's being changed, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. With that, members, any questions to the A2 to put the bill in the shape that the author would like? Seeing none, all in favor of the A2, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Chair Hoppe, House File 1692 as amended.
Well, Mr. Chair, as I said earlier, my idea here is to just have the people in the room, whether it's today or between now and the next time we meet to talk telecom, get together and try to work out things that we can more or less all agree on that get us back up to kind of the regulatory world that we live in today, as opposed to when we last visited telecom regulation. And with that, if there's anybody in the audience that wants to come down and say this is a great idea or a terrible idea, or any specific things that we should be looking at, please feel free.
Representative Johnson, and while he's speaking, if there's anyone else in the audience that would like to testify to the bill or to the issue at hand, now's the time to kind of make your way to the front. Representative Johnson.
The one thing, Chair Hoppe, that concerns me, having looked at the bill just briefly today, was this whole definition of advanced services and being internet protocol enabled services. And I see several times in the bill it says no application to advanced service providers. So basically it takes them out of the loop for different consumer protection type issues. And frankly, it's advanced services providers is all that we have left in the telecom world. That on the second page I see basic telecommunication service, which essentially doesn't really exist anymore. Everybody bundles their stuff in VoIP and so forth. So just as an area of concern as people get together, the stakeholders would be the fact that they're excluded, these advanced service folks, from so many items within the bill itself. That's a concern.
Chair Hoppe.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson. And I think I agree, and I think that's something that everybody here should pay attention to what Representative Johnson says, because he's one of the co-authors and one of the people that's been paying attention to telecom a lot for the last few years. And we might not be able to do something perfect, but I think we want to update our statutes, and that's one of the areas we should be paying attention to.
Representative Johnson.
I think also because I'm a fairly bright guy, and I thank you, Mr. Chair, for your kind words.
Well, I just didn't think that needed to be said. Everyone assumes that.
The one thing I think we heard today during the discussion of the FCC ruling is how chaotic, I think, is the word that Mr. Campbell used, things are right now. So I really have some concerns about the extent to which the Department of Commerce and the PUC are cut out, might not be the right word, but removed from some of their basic responsibilities. And I hope that's another thing the stakeholders keep in mind, that they have an important role to play, and we don't want to just slice them away.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Johnson. I think that's is an important comment. I don't want to have them taken out of this. I think if we can streamline things and maybe get rid of anything that's duplicative. I think we want to keep in mind the reason we're doing this is to try to make it easier for all of these companies to do business, but the long-term goal of this should be to help the state of broadband and telecom in general in the state of Minnesota. And if we can, we want to make sure that we have consumer protection in there, but we also want to do this to make it, you know, with an eye towards making it better for our consumers and businesses in the state. So your point is well taken. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Hoppe. Next testifier.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think we have somebody from the Department of Commerce that wants to come down and share some wisdom with us.
Sure, sounds great. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Dennis Ehlers. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Commerce. The department has looked at this legislation, and I think we agree in many ways with what Mr. Campbell said. I wrote down that he had said that there was indeed some chaos, that it was still a work in progress, that parts of it are currently being negotiated, that there were several appeals and motions for reconsideration at the FCC. And in general, the department's position is that we need to let the dust settle before we take on a major rewriting of the telecommunications statutes. There are some things in the bill that appear to be inconsistent with the role of the state in terms of administering the FCC's program, and also, Mr. Campbell said, there's a big role for the state in this. It's, as I've said in other meetings, there's basically an unfunded mandate here on the state. The FCC put forth a lot of regulations, but basically it leaves it up to the state to enforce them. And so we think we need to get it right, and the department would be glad to work on some comprehensive legislation for the next session after we find out all the fallout from this FCC order.
Mr. Ehlers, are there any questions? Seeing none, I guess I have one for you. It sounded like throughout that testimony that there was sort of a timeline, whereas we may be facing, I think it sounded like some sort of a 2 to 3 year gap in service if we didn't act on some appropriate, not necessarily service, but investment, I guess you could say, in infrastructure or whatnot. Is there any sort of pending timeline in your opinion? And I guess how long does, settling the dust, what type of a time frame do you put on that?
Mr. Chairman, there's really nothing that the state is required to do to make that happen in the short run, but there are a lot of duties for the state to take up in terms of evaluating whether companies are complying and so forth. I guess, I don't know what we can say the dust would settle, but certainly it's going to take a while for the FCC and the courts to get through this and find out what the final order looks like. And so that's why we would be looking at something, I think, in the next session after the parties have had a chance to talk.
Thank you. Members, any other questions? Seeing none, thank you, sir. Appreciate your time. Appreciate it. Anyone else wishing to testify to this bill or to the grandeur telecom issue before us? Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Dan Lipschultz, and thank you for inviting me. I'm here to speak on behalf of what are generally referred to as competitive local exchange carriers, or CLECs. I'm representing a group of those today, including Integra Telecom, Paytech, TDS Metricom, TW Telecom, and Popcom. I wanted to take issue first with one thing Mr. Campbell said. I've been to a Who concert, and that noise didn't sound anything like the concert I was at, although I don't really remember that concert very well. I think that, honestly, Mr. Campbell did a really good job of distilling a 700-plus page order down to its essence. And I think that essence, really, as others have said, is chaos and uncertainty. And that should give all of us pause before embarking upon a significant reform of state laws if, in fact, we are operating, as I think we are, in an environment of even more uncertainty in the wake of that FCC order than we had before, which isn't to say we shouldn't do anything. I think that's more a matter of the timing of what we do than what we do, and I think it in part affects what we might do in a short-term horizon versus a long-term horizon. A couple of things about that order I think have some significant implications for any effort to change the state laws that exist today over telecom. Now, one thing that that order does really at its core is it shifts responsibility for paying the cost of local networks. And it shifts that responsibility from the large long-distance carriers who pay local carriers for the use of those local networks, and it shifts it on to the local end-user customers of the local telephone companies. All of us, in our monthly bills, will presumably or potentially pay more so that that network we have today can maintain at its current level and perhaps expand, as I think we all want it to, into a more sophisticated broadband network throughout the state of Minnesota. And when you think about that, what this FCC order will do is shut off a major source of revenue used to support local networks. And think about the implications of that for any changes in state law. And I'll tell you what the FCC said. They said, don't worry about that. In part, there will be this fund. And they also said, don't worry, states retain the authority to regulate the rates that the carriers will charge their end user customers. Now, my clients are generally in favor of reducing or deregulating retail rates. However, from a public policy perspective where you folks sit and where regulators sit, the FCC has sort of raised the ante a little bit for local regulators in the sense that you will be responsible for looking at these local rates and making sure they don't rise to unacceptable levels to compensate for the loss of this revenue that used to come from long-distance carriers before the FCC order. Another thing that that order does is it cuts off a major source of revenue for competitive carriers like the ones I represent. Now, the carriers I represent, for the most part, won't have access to this universal service fund. So we're going to have to make it up in end-user rates that we charge our customers. But my clients are, by definition, faced with competition. Our ability to raise our rates and remain competitive is a major issue for all of my clients and other competitive carriers who I'm not representing here today. So, again, I don't have an answer, but I think the FCC order raises a lot of questions about not so much maybe whether you do something, but when you do it and what you do. I was on a panel recently out in Washington, D.C. It was a panel actually organized by Commissioner Wergen. And the question she posed to all of us on the panel is whether deregulation is a dirty word. And I hope it's not because I just used it on the record here and it's preserved for posterity. But to credit of Representative Hoppe and others who have authored this bill, that's really, I don't think, what you're talking about conceptually. I'm putting aside House File 1692 for a minute. I think what Chair Hoppe and others are talking about is streamlining and updating state laws, and that makes some sense, again, depending on what you do. And what you do, I think, has to be guided by two principles. First of all, and first and foremost, I think from our perspective and from public policy perspective, make sure that what you do is consistent with the predicate for reducing regulations. And the predicate is competition. The reason we have regulations in the first place of this industry are twofold. First of all, it's a very important industry. Well, that industry is at least as important now as it was 10, 20, 30 years ago when these regulations first hit. I mean, when you think about it, the telecom network, the telecom industry is the major instrument of commerce in this country today. Almost all business is transacted over that network, whether it's by voice or fax or email or broadband. Data is being transmitted over this network. That is the information superhighway of the 21st century is where we conduct business. It's an incredibly important industry, and that in and of itself merits a close, watchful eye by legislators and regulators. The second reason it's been regulated is it's always been or always tended towards monopoly. And that's where competition comes in. We now have, after 10 years of regulations aimed at producing competition, a fairly competitive market. And that does provide the context and a pretext for changing the way you regulate. But I think what you need to do is make sure that any regulations you come up with, any changes in state laws, have to focus on preserving and enhancing competition so that you continue to have the competitive predicate that allows us to reduce regulations that have existed in the past over retail rates and services. And if you keep your eye on that ball, I think you can come up with a streamlined, more modernized approach to regulating telecommunications that is consistent with the public interest, protecting competition, and by protecting competition, protecting the interests of consumers who are best protected by a robust competitive market. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Lipschultz. Members, any questions? Testament to your testimony.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Sir, welcome to the committee.
Please introduce
yourself for the record and proceed.
For the record, my name is Brent Christensen, and I am the President and Chief Executive Officer of the Minnesota Telecom Alliance, and we're a trade association that represents independent telephone companies in Minnesota. We have over 80 members, and most of them, basically it's all the telephone companies in Minnesota except for Frontier and Windstream. And I'm here to kind of just add on a little bit to 1692 and to a couple things that Representative Johnson said. That I absolutely agree with. I don't necessarily agree that there's a lot of things that are still up in the air. There are 27 challenges to the FCC order. There are 13 challenges in court. There are 27 requests for reconsideration. So there's a lot of things going on, but all of those things are really sanding off the rough edges and have little or nothing to do with the core of the order. And the core of the order is that we're changing our regulatory world. And I was sitting back in the back there on my iPhone, and I can't get a cell signal down here. But thanks to you guys putting in the free public Wi-Fi, I get a Wi-Fi signal, and as a result can use my Google Voice. So Google Voice is not regulated at all. Your cell service is somewhat regulated, not by the state, and landline service is regulated by the state and federal government. And one of the things that we have to do from a regulatory policy perspective is to bring those things in line. And those are the things that are changing our world as we deal with it. 1692 is a great way to start, and the concept is there. I think a lot of things have changed since last year when you took up this bill. And we actually have been working with our members on an alternative to kind of take this in line with the changes in the FCC order. I don't call it a deregulation bill. As a matter of fact, I won't let my members call it a deregulation bill. We call it a state and federal alignment bill because it's designed to address some of the things that you were talking about with advanced services and interconnected voice over internet protocol. So we're looking forward to the opportunity to work with the other stakeholders I guess with that, I'd answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Christensen. Members, any questions? Seeing none, thank you, sir. Appreciate it. Chairman Hoppe, I guess I'll give a last call. Anyone else in the audience wishing to testify or share any thoughts? Seeing none, Chair Hoppe, we'll turn it back over to you for any final comments before we lay the bill over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members and guests. I don't want to say that we should all meet here at 8 a.m. Friday morning and talk telecom, but my hope is that people will get together, whether it's by email or some other form of communication or in person, and just try to work things out. And, I mean, I think we've had a lot of good discussion here today, and the whole goal, I think, is to just try to, I won't use the D word, but update and streamline and bring telecom regulation more into line with where we are in the rest of society. So with that, unless there are any final questions, and please, everybody in the audience, feel free to call me. Let me know what the ideas are, what's good, what's bad, what works, what doesn't. And I hope people get together and we can work on things for the common good of the industry. Thank you, members, and Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Hoppe. With that, we will lay House File 1692 on lay it over. And with that, is there any final housekeeping that you have? With that, we lay House File 1692 over, and members, we are adjourned.